Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. As mandated by the High Command of Forces Allied Against the Dark Enlightenment, two guests today. Laura Jadid will report on the far-right's war at a community college in northern Idaho, and Muin Rabbani will discuss Israel's aims in its current multi-front war and on the state of the so-called Axis of Resistance. The right's war on woke college campuses, as they see them, has gotten a lot of attention, but that's not the only battle they're fighting in the higher education theater. Laura Jadid, a journalist who specializes in covering the lurid outposts of American reaction, has an article co-published by Lux Magazine and Teen Vogue on the campaign being conducted by the Idaho Republican Party, a deeply rabid formation, on North Idaho College. That's a two-year institution with 4,300 students that has nothing woke about it, but they're trying to dismantle it anyway. Why? Here's Laura Jadid to tell us. Laura Jadid grew up surrounded by the right. Her parents were Ayn Rand followers, and she was, as she says, a card-carrying libertarian in her younger days. She threw it all over, but it left her with a lifelong fascination with the starboard side of the political spectrum. We briefly discuss Curtis Yarvin. Yarvin, who blogged for years under the nom de net Mencius Moldbug, is one of the founders of what's called the Dark Enlightenment. Yarvin, who it must be admitted is an engaging writer, believes democracy is a fraud and should be replaced by monarchy or dictatorship organized in a corporate model. That sounds wacky, but this worldview has a lot in common with that of tech mogul Peter Thiel, who is the political patron and mentor of J.D. Vance. Laura Jadid. What is the fascination? I mean, I was briefly on the right when I was in college. I left that long behind me, but I've always started this sort of interest in the way they think, because I used to think that way. What's the attraction to you?
Not dissimilar. So I grew up in a household that, not conservative, they'd want me to be specific about that, but objectivist, huge fans of Ayn Rand, a highly individualist, capitalist sort of thinker. Grew up listening to Rush Limbaugh, was at one time a card-carrying libertarian, and basically completely pivoted from that over the course of my 20s. Realized that I'd gotten a lot of things wrong. I consider myself very much on the left today. But I remember very clearly what it was like to take actions that I thought were right based on bad information and bad ideas, but not out of malice, not because I wanted to destroy America or subjugate people or make anyone sad, but because I genuinely thought it was right. And I've always also just been fascinated by why people do what I would consider to be bad things. So I guess that's kind of the double motivation is an interest in why the right is like this, and also a desire to maybe communicate in a way that somebody who doesn't necessarily agree with me can understand that, hey, like, this is why I think you're wrong, and I understand why you think what you do, but, you know, here's my take.
Idaho, the subject of your piece in Lux magazine, particularly northern Idaho. This is a long-building story. The right has been building its forces in Idaho for some decades. Trace some of that history before we get into the specifics of the northern Idaho College.
Idaho, at this time, as you just mentioned, is one of the reddest states in the Union. I feel like Oklahoma might be able to give them a run for their money, but Idaho is a real strong contender. Didn't used to be like that. It was at one time a solidly blue Union Democratic state. In the aftermath of Barry Goldwater's catastrophic presidential loss, the organizer of his campaign in Orange County, California, decided to move somewhere where he felt that he could influence politics in a more direct way than he ever could in California. And after some research, he settled on Idaho. It's a very sparsely populated state. It doesn't take that many voters to change the entire dynamic of the state. He moved there and over time convinced other people to move there who shared his conservative views. Then in the, I want to say late 70s, early 80s, the Aryan Nations built their headquarters in northern Idaho. And so you got an influx of white supremacists as well. Those groups, it's a Venn diagram, but not the same. And basically the end result is that it's just gotten redder and redder and redder over the years.
There's some bleeding over from or to eastern Washington, eastern Oregon, right? There is this sort of white supremacist culture in that broader geography.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I spent 10 years of my life in Portland, Oregon, and it's a very surreal, that whole area, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, a bit of Montana. The white nationalists who moved there chose it because, A, it was seemed like a good place to live off the land. You know, they're big on that. And the other thing was that it has a very small, a low population of non-white people. Oregon was a sundown state. people don't always know that it has that history. It's so famous for being liberal today, but that whole area was not friendly to people of color, and there just aren't very many of people of color up there. So it seemed to the white supremacists that this would be a good spot to establish their white homeland. So they all started moving in, like I said, in the 80s, and it was the whole area. They call it Cascadia, and other people use that term that aren't white supremacists, but that was their idea. Oregon, Washington, Idaho, bit of Montana, white homeland. And so a lot of the people who moved there for that reason are still there. Most of them live outside of Portland, eastern Oregon and Washington, definitely very much so. And northern Idaho is just, there's a lot of good people there, but there's a lot of bad stuff up there, too.
It's the northern part of the state in particular.
Yes.
That seems to be, the Republicans have really set up there and come to dominate the state Republican Party from that base. Isn't that right?
That's absolutely correct. The county that I was in and the county that I write about and the county that is I think, pretty pivotal to the entire politics of the state is called Kootenai County. It's towards the southern end of northern Idaho by a beautiful town. There's a beautiful town called Coeur d'Alene, right in at Coeur d'Alene. And yeah, basically that's where it all got started, this movement to slowly take over the Idaho Republican Party, which started in the Tea Party days, but really picked up steam after Trump got elected.
Now, North Idaho College. Where is it and what is its existence?
So North Idaho College is in Coeur d'Alene, the town that I just mentioned. It is a small community college. The reason that it's named North Idaho College is because there's only four community colleges in all of Idaho. They are all named for the cardinal directions. For context, you can fit over a dozen Connecticuts in Idaho, but Connecticut has 12 community colleges in total. So this is not just another school. This is the only two-year state-run school in the area. This is a little bit of just background on it. You know, we're all pretty familiar with the story of, like, for example, Ron DeSantis going after the New College in Florida and turning it into this kind of, like, conservative bastion. It was targeted because it was viewed to be woke. North Idaho College is not woke by any measure. It's a really kind of a blue-collar place. You can get your welding certification there. They have the top nursing program in the state. This is not a hotbed of liberal activity. It has been targeted, though, by this effort where they've basically gotten people who align with this far-right movement elected to the Board of Trustees, where they've caused so much chaos that it's put their accreditation into question. And they've got till April of next year to fix that, or they will lose accreditation, and that whole area will suffer horrifically if that happens. This, I believe, is very much on purpose. It matches with some dark enlightenment, this idea that, you know, private education is better and destroying public education, especially college where they teach sociology and all those other communist disciplines, just have to be destroyed. And that, I believe, is what's happening. And there's plenty of evidence to back that up.
This is, as you say in the article, no evergreen and certainly no new college. So is it just a convenient target? There's nothing in particular about this institution that would attract their ire.
No, no. And that's the wild thing about it is there really is nothing.
An old friend of mine, this has been many, many years ago, told me this story. He used to track the right, infiltrate their goings-on. And he told me, I can't remember which one it was, but one of the early famous conservative activists of the 70s had a computer model of weather across the country. So they know that there's, like, say, a school board meeting or a school board election or something like that. And it was really bad weather. They would know that's the time we should go pack this meeting. Two things really strike me about this story. One is that they were just so strategic about how to do this, and they had a lot of information and a good computer model. But two, they really paid a lot of attention to things that most people who take politics seriously don't pay much attention to. School boards in small towns and cities. Or in the case of this, a community college. They really are very strategic and very long-term in their thinking. This is a case study in that, isn't it?
Absolutely. These people, they think in terms of decades and not years. These plans have been decades in the making. They understand that they're not going to win at the ballot box, and so they have to win in, for example, down-ballot elections like school board or precinct committee people, which is another big factor in this article, where people just don't pay that much attention to races. Even, like you said, even people who are into politics don't really pay attention to down-ballot races. I've been obsessed politically for as long as I can remember, and I barely pay attention to stuff like that. By quietly finding those little weak spots and very strategically taking over, They're basically treating democracy like a board game, and they're unfortunately winning.
So how do they go about it in this particular case?
There's kind of a dual story here, right? First one is the Board of Trustees, and that one's pretty simple. They just got three out of the five members to be in their camp. they ran on a platform of eliminating wokeness from North Idaho College, which I really can't emphasize enough. Like, I understand that there are colleges that are very progressive and liberal. I went to one of them. This is not that. I'm not saying that because I'm biased. I'm not saying that because I just see, you know, a liberal college as normal. There's no wokeness there, but they ran on that platform regardless. And, then got to work just creating chaos. And they've basically blamed that chaos on the communist forces trying to destroy North Idaho. So it's really very convenient. The more chaos they cause, the more evidence it is that the progressives are really out to get them. The more complicated story is how they took over the Idaho Republican Party, which they did by running for these spots called precinct committeemen. In some places, they're called precinct captaincies. Each party, Democrats and Republicans, have these precinct committeemen. They do get out the vote. They help facilitate voting in these very small precincts of whatever state they're in. And it is a really unglamorous job. You don't get paid. It's voluntary. There's really almost nothing you do, but you do get to vote for the county Republican chair in this case, or Democratic chair if it was the Democratic Party. So what they did is they started to run their people into these little spots. And because nobody wants to do this job, they basically got in unopposed. They were able to elect county chairs that aligned with their views. And then those county chairs were able to elect the state party chair. Currently, her name is Dorothy Moon. And she basically has worked tirelessly for the last 2 years to bend every Republican politician to her will. There are now punishment mechanisms in place for anyone who doesn't vote in lockstep with what the party tells them to do.
The college president was certainly not an ally of these guys, right?
No. So there's been five college presidents since these guys started to meddle. The current president, Nick Swain, he's an ally of the college. He wants the college to function. He's an interesting guy. He's a veteran, a retired, I believe, lieutenant colonel, with like a few deployments under his belt. He's not your typical college president, but he's... Everyone I spoke to in the college had nothing but positive things to say about how hard he's tried to just keep this institution together by working with the various forces and hiring mediators and just trying to make it happen.
But they were able to roll over him?
It remains to be seen. They fired both the president that was in place when the far right came in and began to take over the board. They fired illegally and got sued and settled out of court. And then when Nick Swain came in, they fired him illegally as well, and he also took them to court, and he won and was reinstated as president, where he serves to this day.
I'm speaking with the journalist Laura Jadid. What are their goals, short-term and long-term?
Short-term, they'd like to shut down as many government institutions as they can. In this case, very specifically, North Idaho College. There's some question about what would happen to the land afterwards. Some people speculate it would be sold to developers. Others speculate that some private institution might want to buy it and turn it into a conservative, kind of like the Hillsdale of North Idaho. But the biggest point is to basically destroy the government's ability to provide education, thereby transferring the power of educating the American people into the hands of private organizations, which would be perfect for them, because that means that either, you know, the rich will send their kids to good private schools and the poor will have to find whatever's left, and that will be religious schools. That will be a chance for them to indoctrinate. That's kind of the long-term goal, but the short-term is just to destroy.
Well, it looks like they would really like to put an end to public higher education.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things I talk about in the article is that the Idaho Freedom Foundation, which is the big group kind of behind this push, publicly they state that they understand that like public education will continue. They just want, you know, a robust parallel private system that people can choose, you know, school choice, etc. In that same these articles, they link to articles that say something very different, articles outside of the Idaho Freedom Foundation that do talk about wanting to destroy public education, that do talk about wanting to completely replace it with private education. Again, this is about indoctrination. This is about taking control of the youth. They are aware of the demographic problem they're facing. They're aware that the youth vote isn't on their side. And the way they'd like to fix that is to simply tell the youth what to think from the time they're 6 or 7.
The contrast with somebody like Chris Rufo is striking, though, because, you know, Chris Rufo wants, I don't know, bring back Aristotle and public higher education. These people want to crush it entirely, and their target isn't, as you say, some woke curriculum of New College or Evergreen. It is something that is really crucial to the day-to-day lives of a whole lot of people in northern Idaho.
It absolutely is. It's what happens, I think, when people are truly blinded or taken over by some kind of overarching ideology that doesn't take into account reality. And the reality is, regardless of your political beliefs, it's difficult to see why anyone would want to destroy North Idaho College. Businesses depend on that school to train their workforce. It is a way out of poverty for so many people in that area. It's a job creator. I believe it's one out of every five jobs. It's an astounding amount of the jobs in Coeur d'Alene are directly related to the college. It would destroy the community. I do sometimes wonder, do they understand that? Do they really understand what that would do to the area? And I don't even know. I don't know.
You mentioned a Claremont Institute connection. Who are they and why does that matter?
So the Claremont Institute is a very far-right think tank. They had a lot to do with the attempt to steal the 2020 election. A lot of the big names like Sidney Powell and some others are associated with the Claremont Institute. They served as like a de facto headquarters, if I recall correctly, for that whole movement. They are pushing something very, very far-right, something connected to the Dark Enlightenment, which is this idea that freedom and democracy are incompatible. You actually can't have both, and the only way to have a truly free society is to have basically a monarchy. Anathema to what I think of as America, and to me seems contradictory on its face, but this is something that they seem to believe. And no wonder, because frankly, the American people aren't on their side. It's not that they have no supporters, but the majority of people don't like their ideas, and I think they know.
What you just said sounds like a real Curtis Yarvin territory.
That's exactly who it is. Yes, precisely that guy.
Peter Thiel talks like this, too. I saw a clip of him the other day saying that democracy is over. It is time we move to something. Comparing the United States now to Germany in the 20s, the 1920s, not the 2020s. The sequel to that is something that none of us would.
I personally don't think Germany in the 30s was particularly great, but, you know, I guess we'll have to agree to disagree, Peter Thiel and I. I'm of the controversial opinion that it was bad, actually, that the Nazis took over.
What's this philosophy, exactly? This the Yarvin Thiel. What's their vision?
Their vision is, some people would call them a network state, a sovereign city-state, kind of think like Sparta, right? Not Athens, very specifically Sparta. Run like a startup. So you've got a CEO that makes all the decisions. He's responsible to a board of directors and to the shareholders being the people who live in the city and own a portion of it. This is definitely not like a one-person, one-vote situation. A lot of the times these pipe dreams are fueled by cryptocurrency. They plan to do everything on blockchain. This sounds crazy, I understand. They take it very seriously, and there are efforts to create this kind of network state. There's a place called Prospera in Central America. There are a couple other places that are basically trying to make this happen, oftentimes to the great distress of the government that actually controls the land that they've decided to build these little sovereign states on.
The Yarvin Thiel thing is kind of a high-end version of this, and this what's happening in northern Idaho is much more of a grassroots version of this, but they do share a common vision of where we should all go.
Yes. Absolutely, yes. And it's not as subtle as it used to be. Very recently in San Francisco, there was a conference called Reboot. It was basically about destroying the old order and ushering in the new, which was, I mean, that sounds vague, but that's the vague description they gave. And it was sponsored by Silicon Valley tech billionaires and the Heritage Foundation. They came together to put on this conference. They had discussions about the importance of having lots of babies. They are so aligned. The thing about the idea that sovereign city-state should exist is you don't have to agree on the details. Like, if you want to have your Christian theology over there, that's fine. That's your sovereign city-state. I don't have to do that over here. I can have all kinds of gay rights or whatever in my sovereign city-state. The important thing is that we don't have democracy. The important thing is that a CEO runs everything. So it's really quite compatible. We're so caught up in the culture war that I think sometimes we miss that conservatism goes far beyond that. It's not just culture war stuff.
I often wonder this. I mean, what you're describing is the elite end of it, but more at the grassroots end, what we're seeing in Idaho. Like, who are these people precisely? What's the social base? And what are they so angry about? What is driving these people to such extremes of anger?
That's such a good question. Demographically, I can tell you that a lot of the people driving the bus, oddly enough, come from California. People are coming in from California, believing that the liberals destroyed California and are going to try to destroy Idaho as well. A lot of the people I spoke to for this article, and there are a lot of people who are pushing back on this, and I spoke to quite a few of them, and they basically explained it as people watch Fox News and then just graft whatever story they've heard on Fox News onto local politics. So, like, there's a local bar that supposedly has a basement where weird sex stuff happens. In downtown Coeur d'Alene, I ate there. It's delicious. It's lovely. There's no basement. there's this idea that they, you know, the woke school stuff, right? The DEI, they think this is all there because very clever politicians and think tanks are devoted to convincing them that's the case and telling them that if they don't vote, they're going to lose their way of life. It's going to be a communist hellscape. It's the same tactics everywhere. And just because the threat isn't real in North Idaho, just because that's never going to happen, as one of my sources said, no one is for woke in North Idaho. It doesn't matter. If they're scared, they'll continue to vote like they're scared.
There are a lot of ties between these sorts and the Trump campaign.
Oh, yes. It's a little less than direct, exactly. In this case, it's interesting because a lot of people that oppose this faction also voted for Trump. Not all of them, but a lot of them. It's definitely tied into the MAGA movement. I feel like it's the distillation of what the MAGA movement is at its core. But this is truly more extreme than your average MAGA voter, which is mind-boggling.
And speaking of Trump, you wrote a piece for the New Republic, I believe it was in March, giving his advice how to survive a second Trump administration. Now that the election is right around the corner and a second Trump administration seems like a reasonable possibility, or an unreasonable possibility, could you reprise that advice? What do you recommend we do, and how do we fight it, and how do we survive it?
I don't know if this can happen, but the idea that myself and my co-author Lincoln Mitchell advance is that what needs to happen is a display of the ability of the American people to utterly shut down the workings of this country if Trump crosses the various lines that he's made it very clear he's going to cross. These protests need to not only be nonviolent, they need to be peaceful, because Trump is looking for any excuse to send in the army, the National Guard, whatever he can get his hands on, and declare martial law and put this down by force. Now, he'll probably find an excuse anyway, but it is easier to get sympathy for a cause if you genuinely are not doing anything that is even remotely illegal, like breaking a window, and certainly not hurting anybody. The real harm that I think one wants to do with protests like this is to shut down the economy, to show that, yes, we will grind to a halt as a nation if you go this way. We do not consent to it. I don't know if we have the capacity for that level of protest. I think we may need to find out. I do think about the Women's March in 2016. There were a lot of things wrong with it, but one thing that was good about it is how many people showed up. Mass action is going to be necessary if he wins. I don't know. I really hope that we don't have to find out.
But what you're describing sounds a lot more like a general strike than pussy hats.
Yes, precisely. Yeah, the women's strike. Yeah, it was one day. Everyone marched around and felt good about themselves. This needs to be longer and more serious. The article advocates for one immediately upon on inauguration day, 2 or 3 days of a general strike, just to show that that's a possibility. And then if and when Trump crosses various red lines, it happens again. And I don't just mean he passes tax policy we don't like. If it's just normal Republican stuff, I don't like that. But that's not what this is about. This is about directly resisting what I'm going to go ahead and call fascism. And I think it's important to be very, very clear about what it is that is beyond the pale in American politics. And again, is that going to happen? I don't have a lot of hope for it, but I think that if we could do it, it could be effective.
Yeah, when that term fascist first got applied to Trump, I was skeptical and then kind of recoiled from it, because that word has been overused and has lost some of its power through overuse. But I have come to think, and watching this Madison Square Garden rally the other night, I was just, this is some serious business. It's really not overkill to use that word, is it?
No, I don't think so. I think that we used it a little too soon. I would agree. I think that in 2016, we were on a road that would lead us to where we are now. And I think a lot of people could see that road and they were ready to call it fascism, but it wasn't. It was the road to fascism, which is different. And now that we have reached a point where it is blatantly and overtly fascistic by any definition of that word, I agree with you. We've overused the word to the point where it doesn't mean anything anymore. It doesn't pack the punch that it used to. And that's really unfortunate, because fascism isn't just a comic book villain. It's not just Indiana Jones. It's a ideology that has very little to do with German culture. It is what we're seeing now. And the consequences on that for human life and the human psyche, I think, are immense, and we do have to call it out.
That was Laura Jadid. Her article on the rights war on North Idaho colleges on the websites of both Lux Magazine and Teen Vogue. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after musical break.
Evil men with racist views spreading all across the land.
Don't just sit there on your ass and look at monkey chain dance. Brother, sister, shoot your best. We don't need this fascist groove thing.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing.
History will repeat itself. Crisis point, we're near the hour. Down to force, we do no good.
Some of an old Behind the News favorite, We Don't Need This Fascist Groove Thing by Heaven 17 from 1981. Next, Israel's multiple wars, on Gaza, of course, but also Lebanon, Syria, and what might be the ultimate target, Iran. Making a return appearance on Behind the News to discuss all this is Muin Rabbani, a journalist and analyst with a deep understanding of the region. He has served as the principal political affairs officer with the Office of the UN Special Envoy for Syria, as head of the Middle Eastern section of the Marty Ahasari Peace Foundation, special advisor on Israel-Palestine with the International Crisis Group, and researcher with Al-Haq, West Bank affiliate of the International Commission of Jurists. He is the co-editor of Jadalia, an e-zine that covers the region, where he also hosts its Connections podcast. Muin Rabbani. Starting with a very broad question here, what do you think Israel's goals are in this war, ultimate goals?
If we look at how they started this war, there wasn't much of a strategy to it. Israel's approach seemed to be dominated by bloodlust and revenge, killing people, destroying property, making the Gaza Strip unfit for human habitation. But I think over the summer, something has changed, and I would say that Israel has gradually developed a clear strategy, and that strategy seems to be to take apart the coalition known as the Axis of Resistance. Israel likes to present this as kind of an octopus, where the head is represented by Iran, and all these various movements, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, and so on, are really nothing but tentacles controlled by the octopus, together surrounding Israel with a ring of fire. It's, of course, very different in reality. I mean, it's not as if these groups don't have grievances of their own. It's not as if they would not be fighting Israel if Iran didn't exist. But Israel has basically come to the determination that it is now in a position to dismantle the Axis of Resistance. And we saw this first very clearly in July-August, where it first assassinated Fuad Shukr, the Hezbollah senior military commander in Beirut. Then you had the pager and walkie-talkie attacks. These were then followed by massive bombings throughout Lebanon, and then the assassination of Hezbollah's general secretary, Hassan Nasrallah, another attack that took out more or less the entire leadership of Hezbollah's elite Radwan force. And I think Israel's approach was to decapitate this organization in the belief that if you manage to eliminate so much of its political and military leadership, including its iconic leader who had been in his position for over three decades, if you manage to eliminate all of them within a very compressed period of time, the organization would basically implode, collapse, and Israel would need to do no more than barge into southern Lebanon and deal with the remaining pieces. That's, of course, not what has happened, but I think that was the theory. And I think ultimately Israel would like to see a significant military confrontation with Iran, because again, if this is an octopus, you need to get to the head. And I think that explains these Israeli provocations that we've been seeing towards Iran. And I think, you know, Israel understands that it doesn't have the capacity to significantly deal with Iran on its own. And the United States at the same time has said that while it will defend Israel, it will not participate in initiating an attack on Iran. And I suspect what Israel is currently hoping to do is to create conditions where there is sufficient escalation in the confrontation between Israel and Iran that the line for the United States between defending Israel and attacking Iran becomes increasingly blurred, and Washington is drawn into a direct military confrontation with Iran. There's also, I think, the time factor here, which is that things will change in January when the new administration assumes office in Washington, whether it's Trump or whether it's Harris. I think from Israel's point of view, Biden is kind of unique in his devotion to Israel and his indulgence of its agenda. And I think from Israel's point of view, what is possible between today and January of 2025 may not be possible after that date.
Israel's retaliation against Iran, the recent retaliation, was fairly restrained. What do you think the logic of that was?
Well, here I think we have to look at U.S.-Israeli relations, and I think that this latest Israeli attack on Iran, which, as you noted, was fairly restrained, demonstrates quite clearly that when the United States has clear objectives and is prepared to not only communicate these to Israel, but ensure that Israel abides by them, that's what happens. Despite what I said earlier, the U.S. absolutely does not want the Middle East to blow up in the final stretch between the presidential election. The U.S. does not want Israel to attack Iran's oil facilities, because Iran made very clear that if Israel does so, then Iran will basically paralyze the whole energy sector in the entire Persian Gulf region. And this, of course, would have huge consequences for the price of gas at the pump around the world and so on. And I think the U.S. made very clear to the Israelis that if you're going to hit back at Iran, and the U.S. made clear that it supports Israel in doing so, that it would have to be a limited attack. The other aspect of this is that these things are kind of done in negotiation between the United States and Israel, as if Iran doesn't have a say in the matter. The problem here is that the Iranians said very clearly from the outset that they're not going to distinguish between a minor and a major, a symbolic and a substantive Israeli attack on Iran, and that they would consider any Israeli attack a violation of their sovereignty, and would then hit back even harder than they did on the 1st of October. The Iranians also said that any Iranian response would be immediate and decisive. That obviously hasn't been the case, but there are increasing indications that the Iranians are determined to hit back. If they indeed do so, this reflects their view that the price of inaction has become excessively costly compared to the price of taking the initiative to reestablish deterrence vis-a-vis Israel. Iran is, according to many analysts, has adopted a strategy of what it calls strategic patience over the years, which is to avoid any direct confrontation with either Israel or the United States as it seeks to develop its own capacities, its alliances, and so on. And it views these latest Israeli provocations during the past year, you know, the attack on the embassy in the Syrian capital, Damascus, in April, the assassination of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran in August while he was an official guest of the Iranian government. It sees that the policy of strategic patience is no longer serving its purpose, and it needs to move to a different model in order to ensure that Israel is deterred.
Turning to a narrower question, Gaza. What is the goal there? Emptying Gaza and resettling it? It looks so wrecked, it's hard to imagine anyone going home again there. So what is Israel intending to do?
There are multiple agendas here, I think. One agenda is seeking to eliminate Hamas as a military and governing force in the Gaza Strip. And I think Israel's problem here is that Hamas is Israel's weakest enemy, fighting in the smallest territory. The Gaza Strip is all of 365 square kilometers. It's postage stamp sized. And at this point, even if Israel were to definitively achieve the total eradication of Hamas tomorrow morning, it's been over a year, and the mere fact that it has taken Israel this long to deal with what's basically a second-order militia fighting in territory that Israel has controlled since the late 1960s does not augur very well for Israel. Just yesterday, four elite soldiers were killed in Jabadia, the area in northern Gaza that's been under siege now since the beginning of October, and where Israel has repeatedly proclaimed victory. So one agenda has to do with dealing with Hamas and the other armed movements in the Gaza Strip. Another part of it is making an example out of the Gaza Strip. In other words, to all Palestinians, and for that matter, others in the region who are watching, this is what happens to you. If you dare attack Israel, we will basically reduce your entire territory to rubble. And we're already seeing that in the border zone in southern Lebanon. Israel is also insisting on making or working very hard to make the Gaza Strip, or at least most of it, unfit for human habitation. That explains the systematic attacks on civilian infrastructure, on housing stock, and so on. The expulsion of the Palestinians from Gaza along the lines of, let's say, what we saw in 1948 and to a lesser extent in 1967, that is, at least for the time being, no longer a realistic option because it would require one of the surrounding states, in this case Egypt, to open its borders and accept to receive these hundreds of thousands, more than 2 million people. But if you make conditions of life unsustainable and people can't eat, can't even get fresh water, can't work, can't care for their families and so on, then gradually they're going to start finding ways to leave. You know, the way we've seen in the Mediterranean in recent years, people will start finding ways to smuggle themselves to Egypt and so on. I think that's very clearly also part of the agenda. And then a broader agenda is that, of course, the attacks of October 7th were the most significant attack on Israel since it was established in 1948. It was the first time that Israel had to fight on territory within its internationally recognized borders since the late 1940s. And I think what Israel's leaders now are also trying to do, you know, there is going to be a commission of inquiry. People are going to be held to account in these narrow terms about their responsibility for October 7th and being able to then make the claim that, yes, we screwed up on October 7th, but since then we've achieved A, B, C, and D. I think that's playing in a lot of their minds as well.
I'm speaking with the journalist and political analyst Muin Rabbani. What about this decapitation strategy, the assassination of leaders of Hezbollah and Hamas? Will this decapitation strategy work?
It hasn't in the past, and I don't suspect that it will at present. If we take Hamas first, its leader, Ismail Haniyeh, who was assassinated in Tehran, and I believe it was the 1st of August, it might have been the 31st of July, he was not an operational leader. And so his killing was obviously a blow to the organization. But it was, I think, more symbolic than substantive in terms of its effects. Now you go to his replacement, and actually the individual who's been the movement's most consequential leader in the past several years, Yahya Sinwar, his killing wasn't an assassination. The Israelis didn't even know they had killed him until the following day. His absence or his removal from the scene is going to have an impact on the organization. He was its most consequential leader. And if, let's say, the individual or collective that replaces him climbs down from the demands that he had been making in the negotiations for a ceasefire, assuming for the sake of argument that these are serious negotiations, you know, if they accept anything less than a permanent ceasefire, a full withdrawal of Israeli forces from the Gaza Strip, a proper exchange of captives, then there's going to be dissension within the organization. But in a more specific response to your question, assassination has not proven to be a very good strategy for getting rid of organizations, particularly when you're dealing with a movement like Hamas or Hezbollah, which recognizes that it's dealing with an infinitely more powerful enemy and has over the years put in a system to replace those who it expects are going to be removed from the scene because of Israel's overwhelming advantage in force and intelligence capabilities and support it gets in these respects from the United States and others in the West. And indeed, we've seen that Hamas remains a viable fighting force in the Gaza Strip. In other words, you know, we're not talking about, let's say, an army unit whose ability to fight is completely dependent on orders given by a central command room or a particular general. And once you eliminate that, the movement becomes kind of a headless chicken. In Hezbollah's case, the situation is very similar. I have to say, given the number and rank and particularly the very short time frame in which all these Hezbollah leaders, including its general secretary, Hassan Nasrallah, who had been in office since 1992, so over three decades, the rapidity with which all these people were assassinated, it was a severe blow to the organization because one aspect about Hezbollah, it had developed a reputation for competence, not only in intelligence, but in counterintelligence. And now all of a sudden, Israel had penetrated its supply chain with the pager attacks. It knew the locations of the underground bunker of its leadership. It was able to eliminate in one act the leadership of its elite military force and so on. And Israel expected that this kind of swift decapitation would lead the organization to implode, to collapse. And I have to say, Israel was far from alone in this. I think many other people, perhaps understandably, also believed that an organization, even one as powerful and experienced as Hezbollah, would simply prove unable to withstand these repeated, severe, rapid blows to its command structure. But what we've learned since then is that Hezbollah had prepared very well, not only for an Israeli invasion, but also for the eventuality that in a conflict with Israel, that Israel would be able to use its overwhelming advantage in force to wipe out several layers of the senior command ranks. And on the one hand, it had prepared people to rapidly replace those who were killed, and at the same time, it has also developed a much more decentralized structure so that those, for example, on the Israeli-Lebanese border are not dependent on those further north, whether north of the Litani River or in Beirut or in the Bekaa Valley, for either instructions or for logistical supplies or anything else. And the speed and rapidity with which Hezbollah has been able to regain its composure and also to a certain extent also to begin taking the initiative and to also defend the very border zone in southern Lebanon, despite these severe and very demoralizing blows, I think surprised a lot of people.
This is a question, a big one, I've been looking for an answer to for a long time, and I can't get a really satisfactory one. What does Israel mean to the U.S.? Why the intense attachment? Some people will point to AIPAC and the lobby, others to the U.S. national security interests, some hybrid of the two. How do you see, what is the source of this passionate attachment?
It's a very good question. Clearly, the lobby does play a role, although that's mainly at the level of, let's say, elected officials rather than setting policies by the state as such. Israel is also clearly seen as a regional proxy of the United States and of the West more generally in the Middle East. You know, you've probably seen this famous speech by Biden when he was head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, basically saying if Israel didn't exist, we'd have to invent it. I also think that that role of regional proxy has diminished considerably since the end of the Cold War. And recently in a discussion about this very question, the answer that was given is that Israel, which in many ways was seen by the United States as a means to an end, has over the years metamorphosed into an end in itself. And that, in other words, the U.S. just has this passionate attachment to Israel that exists independently of the role that Israel may play in U.S. regional and global strategy, independent of the power and influence of either lobbies in the United States, such as the Israel lobby, or core constituencies like the evangelical Christian vote. Just as you have the special relationship with Great Britain, you have the special relationship with Israel that over the years has kind of assumed this life of its own, to the extent that it now exists independently of any rational explanation. I know that's not a precise answer to your question, but I think it comes pretty close to an accurate one.
The other day we saw the remarkable spectacle of Rutgers University using bulldozers in a nod to the IDF to knock down a succotash that some Jewish students had erected as a peace symbol. That kind of repression of dissent, but also religiously mediated dissent like that, is just stunning to me. Do you have any thoughts on what is going on with these institutions like the universities in the U.S.?
I think there's two issues here. First of all, I found this case particularly noteworthy because, of course, this whole campaign is being undertaken under the pretext of assuring the security of Jewish students and staff and faculty members in this very polarized atmosphere, particularly on U.S. campuses. But when they're actually, as you noted, using bulldozers to demolish a Sukkot encampment set up by Jewish students, it kind of becomes difficult to sustain that explanation because, as we now clearly know, what's going on is you know, making the country safe for Israel and for supporters of Israel's genocide. And if Jewish students get in the way, they will be demonized and vilified and dealt with severity, just like anyone else. So again, we're dealing with this very false conflation of Jews, Judaism, Israel, and Zionism. But I think in the broader picture, despite the very real costs that people are having to pay in terms of jobs, in terms of career, in terms of reputation, in terms of being threatened and having their families threatened and their home addresses publicized and so on. When it gets to the point where you need to adopt these kinds of measures and implement these kinds of repressive campaigns, it's a sign of defeat. It means you can no longer engage an argument and win it, and that the only way you can defend your position is by mobilizing the power of the state, the power of courts, the power of university administrations to repress and delegitimize and effectively remove the other side of the argument from the debate. Because if there's a real discussion, you're going to lose.
Yeah, it does seem like Israel has lost the support of most younger Americans, Jewish or not.
Yes.
It's a remarkable transformation going on.
Yeah. Who would have ever expected it? When I was a college student in the United States in the 1980s, not only were the overwhelming majority of Jewish students solidly pro-Israel, but I would say a clear majority of American youth was pro-Israeli. And this was kind of in the aftermath of the 1982 invasion of Lebanon. It's a very different reality now, where you can almost, in a sense, I don't think it's too much of an exaggeration to say that the attitude of Jewish university students to Israel is becoming not unlike that of white university students to apartheid South Africa during the 1980s. I mean, for many in this environment, university campuses and among youth and so on, Israel has become a dirty word.
And finally, how much of a difference to the region would there be between a Trump and a Harris presidency?
I think it's very difficult to give a clear answer to that. Perhaps the key question is not so much the difference between Trump and Harris as the difference between Biden on the one hand and either Trump or Harris on the other. Biden has been kind of uniquely devoted to Israel and the implementation of its agenda, uniquely indulgent of Israel. And if you look at either Harris or Biden, I mean, Harris, I think, would represent the traditional U.S. policy of unconditional support for Israel as opposed to fanatic devotion of it that Biden represents. Whereas in terms of Trump, On the one hand, yes, Netanyahu, and most Israelis for that matter, according to the available public opinion polls, have a clear preference, at least 2-1 for Trump. And Trump has been much louder in his typically vulgar fashion of support for Israel. But Trump is also seen by the Israeli leadership, just as he's seen by everyone else, as kind of an erratic and unreliable figure. So if he wins the election, he could come into office and lead a massive attack on Iran. And he could just as easily say, you know, I don't want this headache. Let's put an end to it. So it's very difficult, to say. I mean, if you look at it on the evidence, perhaps there's every reason to believe that a Trump presidency would be a bigger disaster for the Middle East than a Harris presidency. But with Trump being so erratic and unpredictable and unreliable, you never really know what you're going to get. But I would also just make one more point. While the differences between them are certainly very real in terms of domestic politics and perhaps with other foreign policies, we shouldn't focus exclusively on distinctions and differences when talking about U.S. policy towards the Middle East. We should also look at continuities. And here, you know, if you look at the Biden administration, its policies, whether on Palestine, on Iran, on Western Sahara, on virtually every other issue related to the Middle East, were literally indistinguishable from what we might have expected from a second Trump administration. So there's a lot of continuities here that we also need to look at.
It's amazing. Biden gives Israel everything it wants, and yet he doesn't get any thank you at all.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, just one more point. You know, Israel has become kind of so hysterical that, yes, there's a clear preference for Trump, and Harris is seen almost as an enemy. And although, you know, she has refused to distance herself even one iota from Biden's unconditional support for Israel and has treated what would otherwise be natural constituents with total contempt.
That was Muin Rabbani, who is, among many things, the co-editor of Jadalia, an Ezeen in Middle Eastern Affairs. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some of the Spanish dance from Dmitri Shostakovich's suite The Gadfly, a piano transcription of what was originally part of the soundtrack to a 1955 Soviet movie performed by Vladimir Ashkenazy. Till next week, bye.